It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
No, seriously, we were just watching a thing the other day where the director of RRR was breaking down one of the particularly interesting scenes, and it was absolutely cool, and we're both just like, we need to watch this movie again. It's an amazing movie. There's nothing like it in the West. Check it out. It's great. It's really good. It's awesome. We love it. Suppose I should have had a cold open for this part. I have something. I actually thought this one was interesting because I mentioned it to Trish, and she was like, I don't think William's going to like talking about that. And I was like, actually, I can see why you would think that, but I don't think that's true these days for a couple different reasons. But anyway, I find myself pondering something. I have a question. And unfortunately, it's a question that is on so many levels impossible to answer. But I find myself pondering it. And the question is as follows. And it's really sort of a grouping of questions, but it'll make sense. I'm not talking about social perspectives. I am not talking about social norms. And I am not talking about orientations or preferences. I am talking about actual physical acts. I wonder if there is a change in the amount of sex people have throughout, as time goes on, compared to other time periods. And not just sex in general, but like homosexual sex or like specific sex acts. Because from a social messaging point, we are arguably in sort of the most libertine era of modern Western society, where people are much more open about having sex and are much less shamed compared to other time periods and things like that. But if there is one thing I have learned through conversations and stuff with old people and stuff, is that while many time periods in the past were very, the messaging was very like sex outside of marriage is terrible and you can't do that and it's all, you know, whatever, people were still doing it plenty. And you know, old people always like to talk about like, you young people thought, and I mean, I know weird stories about people who had flings that are back in the 50s that I'm like, that's weird. But like, so we can never know, but I'm very curious, like, was there less, like, was there more or less or the same per capita, like, premarital sex in the U.S., say, in the 50s, compared to, like, the 2010s?
Well, first of all, we overestimate the power of social messaging. We also underestimate
it. I mean, I know
it. I do. We also underestimate it. There are a lot of, you know, like, there are a lot of people that think representation doesn't matter. It certainly does matter. But it doesn't, it's not all powerful, right?
Yeah.
For all time, as far as we know, based on any research or any literature we can find from past eras and everything else, as long as there has been like a popular social messaging in an empire type of situation, there have been people who in public acknowledge it and smile and nod, and in private. And not only that, but there have been people who know that they're doing, like, everybody knows that's happening.
Yeah.
But that's just part of the acceptable social fabric, is in public you say this, and if it's okay if in private you do it, but you have to do it in private.
A veneer, as it were.
Yeah. So not only is there this two-tiered thing, everybody knows about it. And the only people that are really ostracized are the ones who try to break it. Like, well, so-and-so does this all the time. Shut up. You know, we don't talk about that. It's okay if they do it as long as we don't talk about it. Now, some societies, of course, wanted your public and private life to be the same, and they interfere in other people's private lives. That does happen in like Puritan societies and things like that. You get people paying attention. But there are a lot of cultures, and I think we know this, a lot of 19th century culture was like this. Nobody thought behind closed doors everybody was being whatever. Well, nobody thought that.
These are the two examples that I specifically know of from history that I learned about. One is the Victorian era, where we all like think, oh, they were super repressed or whatever. It's like, yeah, that was the on the surface thing, but no, they were definitely getting down. And actually, it's interesting. The other interesting one is Puritan society, because
sure. Some of them.
Well, two big things about like early American Puritans and stuff. By and large, premarital sex was okay.
Mm.
The big caveat being, if you get pregnant, y'all are getting married.
Right, right.
And that's happening. And they also were aware of the significance of sexual pleasure, and specifically aware that for women, the clitoris was a big part of that.
Some of them believed you couldn't get pregnant without the woman having an orgasm.
Yeah, like, and that is, I mean, that's literally the word. The word we use for sexual repression is puritanical. Like,
yeah.
And those, and these are the things. I'm like, how, and you say, like, everybody knows this. Even today, I find people still surprised at individuals who maintain a certain social norm in public, and then they find out that privately they're not. So not everybody gets the memo. No.
I'm not suggesting now we're like that. I think we are still like that though. Well, there are some things I think that are performative. Everybody knows the person doesn't think this, that, or the other thing, but it's performative and they expect them to do that. And they don't really think behind closed doors. But I think when it comes to,
and we've had a really big rash of conservative politicians who were very homophobic, who then got caught in scandals where they were having homosexual sex.
But for a long time, I think in our culture, in American culture, I can't account for any place else, but I think for a long time in American culture, we've had this cultural expectation that there might be some things you can perform where everybody knows it's a performance and they don't expect, but I think there's a lot of things people expect you to be frank and honest about.
Yeah.
That they think that in your private, that they would be surprised in your private life that you didn't adhere to. And, you know, also I think social media has really encouraged younger people to put a lot of their private life, though mostly also performative, to put a lot of their private life out there. And sometimes I wonder if, you know, the whole bullying thing, it actually encourages more disclosure, because the idea is I need to get out in front of my reputation, you know, so that I can keep it on the positive and people liking me. So in case someone comes along and says something bad, it won't, you know, people will dispute it and be on my side and things like that.
And we are in an era where people will cultivate a reputation of being sexually active and sexually adventurous. And it turns out in private, actually, they are not. So we'll get the opposite now.
Especially in
a lot of younger generations.
That's cool nowadays
and stuff. But we're never going to have any on the ground data, especially in history.
Right.
Of like how much was actually. And so I find myself wondering, because there are some things that, because of my socialization and because of media and things like that, there are certain aspects that I know happen in modern society with regard to sex that I'm just like, I just can't imagine like people in the 1930s doing that. But I'm also like, but we didn't invent it. So.
Well, I think one
like,
thing you can,
like, people have been giving blowjobs way longer than the term blowjob, and yet the idea of like somebody in like Roman times giving a blowjob just seems really weird to me.
Yeah, we're kind of conditioned to think that way, I think. But
right,
one thing we can observe with people today is that if someone wants to do something, they're going to find a way to do it. And that's probably been true of humans for all of the last 300,000 years. So you can, even if your thought about a certain era is that they wouldn't like a certain thing, which sometimes you don't even know that. You just think that for some reason.
Yeah.
But let's say you knew for a fact that it was like forbidden and nobody should do it. There were people doing it. And there were some people just trying it because it was forbidden. So
That's
just always been true, probably.
And piggybacking on something we talked about, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now, this idea that there exists such a range of, we like to say, flavors of sex,
mm-hmm.
such that it is possible to be an individual who has a fetish or kink for a particular kind of flavor and to not be aware that you do because you are not aware of the existence of such a flavor.
Yeah, I suppose
and
that's
I
true.
Will say that I think in a more modern society and a more publicly, socially permissive society, the ability to explore the breadth of flavors is easier. So there are potentially there are potentially certain flavors that are much more prevalent now, just because nobody was in a position to even have the idea, hey, what if I'm really into putting my junk in a high-heeled shoe or whatever.
Yeah, right, right. I mean,
and I think that becomes very culturally interesting because, you know, the further you go back, being able to explore those things is going to be an issue of privilege. You have the resources and the clout and the power to be able to do this and to be able to do this and keep it hidden or whatever. So the further you go back in history, the more your flavors are mostly going to attach to straight white men.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, the people I know of who have developed things like that later in life, because they didn't know it existed, have all been women. And it's definitely like you say, like it just simply did not occur to them until maybe they saw some pornography or something online and they saw something and they went, that's a thing, you know? and they were completely into it after that.
I have personally had that. And in fact, I mean, and I'm going to try and keep things nice and vague because I know you're more comfortable that way, but I believe I have been upfront about in the history of my life, I have many times and many phases in my life engaged in text-based online erotic role play.
Sure.
And I have explored a lot of kinks in that fashion, including a lot of flavors that are things that are either physically impossible or things that like, that would be insane to do in real life.
Right, right, right.
So I would not do that. Or things that as we've talked about before, I like the fantasy of it. I would hate the reality of it.
I think that's true for lots of people.
There have been things. I mean, first of all, I have obviously learned about flavors that I'm like, that's a thing. I didn't know that was a thing. And some of them I've been into. But there have also been things that I knew about. And just like when I heard about it, I was like, yeah, that's clearly not for me. And then I was in a situation where like my partner at the time was like, can we indulge in this? And I was like, okay, I can try it out. And suddenly I was like, oh crap. I think I kind of like this. I assumed I wouldn't, but like in the moment I'm kind of into it. So
interesting.
And I feel like in a modern society, we are more able to do that kind of exploration. So well, there is that factor
in our modern society. I mean,
very true. And again, it's as a general rule, the real answer is throughout history, it's going to go up and down and whatever, but, sure. And right place, right time. And I also want to say, if you really have a thing, sometimes it's powerful enough that you may not know it's a thing in the world, or a thing that anyone can have, and yet you still feel it. I mean, it's not like when humanity first got created, there was already a list. Like, people had to be like, you know what? I think I'd like to do things with my bits related to such and such. And yeah, they tried it out and they're like, yeah, this is awesome. And then they told their other friend, and he's like, oh, yeah, no, that's gross. You're horrible. Get away from me. But then they told a different friend, and that one was like, oh, yeah, this sounds good. And like, so, I mean, I get that it's always exploring uncharted waters, so to speak. But I just, yeah, I find it all fascinating. And I hate the fact that because of the way time and space works, and also the way privacy and society works, we'll never, there are aspects of how this works that we'll never know. And I'm really curious.
And to me, it's even worse than that, that, you know, one thing I've kind of noticed about human behavioral science my whole life, but definitely going through a graduate program, I've seen that I've actually read enough textbooks and read enough articles to see it pretty much confirmed that if there's one thing that human behavioral science is really awful at understanding, or even trying to understand, or even showing that they want to understand, it's culture in general and sex in particular. They don't care about understanding what culture is, how it works. I think they tell themselves that they understand it, or some version of it, or maybe they kind of tell themselves that it's impossible to understand, so they don't even really try. And somehow sex gets worked
into the idea that behavior is culture, because it's the seeing is believing thing. This is what people do, so clearly this is the culture. It's like,
right. And somehow,
especially when you get into sex.
Yeah, it impacts sex, like with both culture and sex, and I don't know if they're related somehow, but with both of them, they only go so far and then they quit. And it's it's like they don't want to know what goes beyond that line for whatever reason. Like, maybe when it comes to culture, it's like, well, if we figure out things empirically about culture, well, then we can't make the stuff up that we want to make up, you know, or sex too, maybe. I don't know.
At some point in history, we decided sex is, by definition, an intimate act, and arguably one of the most intimate acts. And tied to intimacy is vulnerability, and vulnerability makes people uncomfortable. Mm. Now, the reality is, I see how we got there. And I mean, this has been going on for centuries, millennia. Right. I feel that way too. But looking especially at some more modern science fiction authors, and actually some earlier science fiction authors who present societies where that is not the case,
mm-hmm,
makes you sort of realize that doesn't inherently have to be the case. Sex is an act that involves physical touch and things, but and we have versions nowadays too. A lot of people consider massage therapy to be a very intimate act, and other people consider it to be no more intimate than going to your doctor and getting a physical, which admittedly we also have issues tied into physical contact and nudity and how that ties into intimacy, but that's or anything. So I mean, I think that's part of it, is whether we're aware of it or not, we're uncomfortable about sex, and so we don't focus as much. But I don't know, this again goes back to what I talked about last week, or in our case a half hour ago, this current season of Taskmaster, and Frankie Boyle in particular. There was a task in which they had to get a banana down from a tree, and there was a tree outside, and they just said, you got to get a banana out of the tree. So they go outside, and what there is in the tree, there is a sign that says banana, and it was an arrow, and next to it, they had put an actual banana. It was like a pine tree, but they put a banana in there, and so people had to get it down. And three of the people went and got it down. Two of the people didn't see the actual physical banana. They saw the sign, so they got the sign. And they thought that was correct. And there became this huge debate amongst the contestants over what that, whether that should count. And Frankie Boyle in particular is like, the whole way we operate is words are symbolic of the things. And a physical sign that says banana is essentially a banana. And there was lots of debate about this, whatever. Episodes later, there's a task that involves collecting a bunch of pineapples.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very complicated. There were some pineapples floating in the water, but they weren't allowed to leave a certain spot. So they're trying to find ways to get it. And the big joke was actually around the corner were a bunch of different kinds of pineapples just sitting there. And it was different kinds. There was an actual pineapple, but there was also like a metal sculpture of a pineapple. There was also an inflatable pineapple. There was one made out of cotton candy. There was a can of just chunks of pineapple. And these are all pineapples. So one of the contestants got this idea and got a pen and paper and drew like 13 pineapples. And so the question of whether this was going to count came up. And the contestants who didn't do this were like, oh, fuck no, 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 no. And the contestant who did it was like, earlier, Frankie argued so strongly that a sign that said banana was a banana. And Frankie poked up and he says, and I'm not going to argue it again. A drawing of a pineapple is a pineapple. And bear in mind, Frankie's not the one who did it. But he's like, no, it very clearly is. And he's like, this is the whole nature. And so finally at the end, Greg, the taskmaster, declares he's going to count the drawings. And one of the contestants was really mad. And he said something like that. How can you do that? Or something like, what are you basing that on? And Frankie says, in his loudest and most angry I've seen him in this series, he says, the basic concept of language. Yep, exactly. So I don't know why that made me think of it. Welcome. Magical talking hat. Oh,
something different.
I forgot.
Oh.
It was the magical. Oh, I remember.
Okay.
The magical shocking rat.
Oh, shocking. Podcast. Oh.
The only podcast in the world that is continuing to workshop our new rebranding. The problem being, I very clearly thought of this beforehand. And had to very carefully think now about it to remember it, which really undercuts the joke when I now say, oh, wait, I think that's just Pikachu.
Oh, I was thinking of a rat that tells off color jokes. So I was way off, I guess.
I'm just seeing Rizzo from the Muppets being like, you know what the problem with women is?
Right. That's, yeah, something like that. Or how Chucky, have you seen those documentaries about the original Chuck E. Cheese where Chucky was like this, had this Jersey accent and he would tell these jokes or whatever?
Remember I told you before about Caesar's World, the channel where he takes like horror movies and sort of comes up with an overarching story that kind of makes sense?
Yeah.
Well, a long time ago, he, as a joke, did one about Chuck E. Cheese that was sort of in the Five Nights at Freddy's. And apparently it was really popular. So recently he did one that I watched about Grimace from McDonald's.
I watched that. Yeah, it's pretty good.
The history, but the actual legit history of Grimace is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
He originally had four arms and was a villain. And also, this is the thing that because I knew about the villain thing. I did not know about the four-arm thing.
I didn't either. I didn't know about the evil thing either.
There is a strong bad email in which he said they are talking about something, and he says it is very rare and difficult to find now, like such and such or four-armed Grimace.
Oh, he says that.
Which I always just assumed was a joke he pulled out of his ass. What is a thing?
It is a thing, yeah.
Which reminds me of another story. But first, I just say, I'm Tony.
Oh, and I'm William. This is episode 645.
Real long intro. Okay. My world got rocked yesterday. Hard. So, I want to talk for a minute about Valerie Harper, the actress.
Mm-hmm.
Best known, I think, for playing Rhoda on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and later the spinoff Rhoda.
Yeah, I think that is what she's best known for.
I am a fan. I have always kind of been a fan of hers. And I was sad that she died and kind of wished she had not died as soon as she had so that we could see more of what she was capable of.
Right.
And I'm mentioning this to my sister yesterday on the phone because I am again talking about that Being Mary Tyler Moore documentary that I watched, we watched recently. I think I talked about it a few weeks ago that I still recommend. Mac, it's funny. Recently, a friend of mine got Max and I was giving her all my recommendations. And for movies, I just had documentaries. Like I couldn't think of other ones that are on Max that I wanted to recommend, but I was like, the Tina Turner documentary kicks ass, the Mary Tyler Moore documentary kicks ass, and the George Carlin documentary is way too long, but also is really fascinating. But so we're talking about this, and it eventually leads us over to Betty White, of course, and it eventually leads us over to the show Hot in Cleveland that used to be on TV Land that Trish and I watched, and about three seasons in, we kind of bailed, not because it wasn't good, but the plots started seeming like we've seen this before kind of thing. They seemed to be running out of new material and we just got bored. So we stopped watching, but they had guest stars on there. That was a lot of people from these old shows and things. And Mary Tyler Moore in particular would show up. And she was, I think Betty White's character was in prison at a certain point, and Mary Tyler Moore was like her cellmate. And it was fun, 'cause they were these like hardened criminal things. But apparently in a late, like one of the last episodes in the last season, they came up with an excuse and they basically brought in every surviving member of the cast of Mary Tyler Moore on an episode. And she's telling me about it. And she's like, and so Mary Tyler Moore and all this stuff. And she's like, and Valerie Harper's there. And I'm like, she can't be. She died. And she's like, this was before she died. And I was like, no. She died a long time ago. And my sister's like, well, you got to remember, this was like, what, 2014 or something? And I'm like, no, Sarah, she died in like the 90s. And my sister's like, no, she didn't. And to be fair, my sister will speak with that level of confidence and be 100% wrong.
I don't remember. The most recent
time this came up is when she was confident that when Paul Walker died in the Fast and Furious movies, his character also died. That is not true. His character is retired, even though the guy's dead, and it's made for some really awkward moments in that series, but whatever. But so I'm talking to her on the phone, so I'm like, well, fuck it, I'm gonna look it up on the Wikipedia. So I look it up. Here's what happened. In the mid 80s, Valerie Harper got a new sitcom called Valerie.
Mm-hmm.
Two seasons in, she's gone. And her character in the show died. Sandy Duncan came into the show as like a relative or something.
Yeah, I kind of remember that.
Became the mother figure for this.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
I watched this show. And I apparently, because I would have been like 10.
Oh, you thought she really died?
Apparently.
Oh.
She died in 2019.
Oh, I thought it was like 2014 or something.
2019.
Huh.
And I thought she basically died in 87. And up until yesterday, I believed that.
Wow.
Mind blown. And I'm immediately like, so there's decades more of her stuff that I just have never seen. So I'm immediately looking up what she's in. I'm fine. Like, she hasn't really done much except some, like, reality TV and shit.
Why did I think it was, like, more like...
Absolutely blew my mind.
Well, I mean, I think... When I think 5 years ago, for some reason, I still think 2015, even though 5 years ago would be not that. So I don't...
Yeah, no. But also, it's kind of funny, because what actually happened with that show is essentially they pulled a Roseanne and the Conners thing. Because what happened, and Wikipedia was not clear on why, but to the end of the second season, Valerie Harper was fired from her show with her name on it, called Valerie, and yet they kept the show going. And in fact, she sued Laura Marr over it, and it was a whole deal.
Yeah, I remember.
I don't know why
happened.
She was fired, but that's
I don't either.
Bizarre to me.
I remember, all I remember is she left the show. I knew she wasn't actually dead
apparently,
or whatever.
Apparently, she was booted out the show.
Wow, I didn't even know that. I thought
but
she just.
I guess I was a kid, and in my head,
she must really
I just
died.
Was like, she died. Well, and there have been plenty of sitcoms where people died, and then in the show, they died. John Ritter, one of the dudes on Suddenly Susan, all sorts of stuff where they've done that. Coach on Cheers. I'm pretty sure that's how that went down. So maybe, I don't know, but like, I have moments where like you hear somebody died and I'll be like, oh, I kind of thought they were already dead. Or I actually had this with Mary Tyler Moore where she showed up on something and I was like, I thought she was dead. And then she died and somebody told me and I was like, oh, I thought she was still alive. like I go both ways on that. But like, yeah, I guess my brain just assumed that because I've literally and I talk about like I it's not like I don't mention this or whatever. I just have always I always thought she died then, and that's why she wasn't in the show. And she lived to fucking 2019. It's insane. It's crazy.
Yeah, I often will hear someone passed away, and I was sure that, I mean, not in maybe in the 80s or 90s, but I mean, I was sure somehow I had it in my
head. If it's a recent one, it's usually they haven't really done much and I never really cared that much about them. So whatever, but yeah, it was crazy. All right. I want to talk. I have another topic real quick. It's the last thing on my list and you're going to love this one. I'm not even lying. So apparently, Okay. We're gonna tiptoe here. Frankenstein. The movie.
Which movie?
The oldest one that's not a silent film?
You probably mean the 1931 one that...
I think so, yes. And its follow-up, Bride of Frankenstein.
Okay, so the 1931 and Bride of Frankenstein, yeah.
Yes. Both directed by?
Did Whale? Yeah, he probably directed them both, right?
Yes. So apparently, starting in the 70s and continuing on to now, I wouldn't say there's a consensus, but there is a large faction, a significant faction of people who our film students and things like that, who now see those films as an allegory for homosexuality.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I never knew this. And it tracks really well. But yeah, I've never heard about this. And apparently it's because Whale was apparently openly gay.
In that time period,
which was like, how do you do that? That's insane.
Isn't Gods and Monsters about him and
oh, is it?
I think so. And
I've seen Gods and Monsters. I didn't remember that's who it was. That would make sense. That would make a lot of sense.
Oh, I thought that was about him. Maybe it isn't.
I'm sure it is. Well, it makes sense because, yeah, they're talking about, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. I don't know how I ever never put this together. The reason it came up is the Scaredy Cats guy. Remember I've talked about, I shouldn't say guy. It's Scaredy Cats person who does the horror movie things. I think I talked about him before on here.
I think so, yeah.
they are currently doing, going through and looking at the Reanimator movies.
Mm.
And they are seeing a similar through line.
Oh.
Because the Reanimator movies involve two scientists. One of whom is Herbert West of Lovecraftian fame. And one of whom is ostensibly sort of the hero of most of the movies. And they work together. And it's a constant struggle of the nice one, like saying, this is horrible. We can't do any of this terrible stuff anymore. And the other guy sort of bringing it back. And he maintains that there's very much, like, in general, the Herbert West is not a sexual character in the thing, but he definitely, like, is obsessed with this guy. And, like, because that guy always ends up with, like, romantic partners within the film. And Herbert West is always, like, very obviously, like, sabotaging those burgeoning relationships and manipulating to stick around. And the guy's like, I think he's kind of in love with him. And then later he's like, I'm not sure he's capable of love. And there's a sociopathic thing. But, like, I think he wants him. And this is the thing. And he brings up, he's like, this strikes me very much as how it went. And Bride in particular, because that's the thing of you're essentially artificially creating the heterosexual lifestyle that you're supposed to have and that kind of thing. And so he's drawing some of the things. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing. And I find it vaguely interesting. We've never talked about this before because this shit is your jam.
Yeah. I mean, I like those. I mean, I don't think they're based on Mary Shelley at all, but I think as their own thing, I think they're quite amazing, especially for their time. I like watching them and I'm very interested in them. I think the second one's really even better than the first one. And I arguably, I mean, when people talk about that aspect, you know, of Wales' influence, his personal life influence on the films, I think they generally think the second one is very much more, you know, he's very much more.
It's a little bit more explicit because you literally are comparing and contrasting.
Yeah. And there's another scientist involved that, you know, that he has the two scientists that have a kind of relationship there too. And just the whole thing. And the second one has a more interesting and complex plot, really, all the way around. It's a lot of people think that his mark as an auteur is sort of more on the second one than even the first one.
Well, because the argument also potentially goes that may be the way because he had to have a hit first, because there are things that he clearly occluded so that it wouldn't be, because like, the assumption is that if the studio executives in the 1930s knew that this was an allegory for homosexuality, they would probably not have been okay with that. So you kind of had to do it to a degree that they wouldn't notice.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot to the first one. It still has a lot of brilliant film craft things to it that you can appreciate. Filmmaking is interested in the kinds of things they were doing back then. The second one to me is like I personally like the second one better. Even I like the first one fine. I don't think they have anything to do with Mary Shelley's work, but by themselves, yeah, I think they're really good.
I just watched I think today that made some reference to it. Somebody was trying to create a brand new iconic Halloween monster or whatever. The thing I was watching, and they eventually started making jokes related to Mary Shelley and something about how like this is an idea that was the kind of idea that made Mary Shelley run away from that villa and get away from that jerk Lord Byron and come up with a new idea. And the other one's like, yeah. And she suddenly was like, bolts in the neck. That'll be really scary. And to be fair, they were very clearly, they knew how silly that was. Like, that was the point. Like, they weren't, that was their idea, is that Mary Shelley got so sick of Lord Byron that she fled that villa in Geneva and then went somewhere else and was suddenly like, oh, bolts in the neck are really scary. And then wrote Frankenstein. There you go.
She did talk about having a nightmare, really, about this, the story.
Well, yeah. Have you still never watched that Gothic movie? You should watch
no,
it.
No, I think I did watch it.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about
the
things
she
wrote. I'm
sure it's not accurate, but it's another one of those. It's like the One Night in Miami thing. And I love this. For all that I hate biopics, I do love the kind of movie where they're like, we know for historical record that these famous people got together in this place, and we have no idea what happened when they were in that place because it was private. So here's a story about what might have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. I love that because it is, by definition, not true because it's about something we can't know about. So I'm like, this is cool. But this is cool to play with the idea. And honestly, if biopics were more open about that, I still haven't seen it, but Rocket Man, the Elton John one, they start off by saying this is based on an absolutely real fantasy, I believe is literally the opening thing. And I'm like, that's how you do it. Like, stop bullshitting that there's other stuff to it. But, you know, like Bohemian Rhapsody, which do not fucking get me started. Anyway, give us another email.
Okay. Jazz, the subject is symbolic reasoning versus analogy.
Jazz has got me inside my own head bad. For those of you who don't read the blog, first of all, shame on you. Second of all, we're still watching Station 11, and Jazz gets on there and is like, I stopped watching it when a certain thing happened in the series. And I don't want you to tell me, Jazz, because I want to see. But, like, I'm really scared now because I'm warming to the series. I'm about 3 episodes in, and I'm enjoying it. And I'm, like, waiting for that shoe to drop. Because also, I feel like, in my head, Jazz has a much higher capacity for putting up with certain types of bullshit that I am not. So I'm like, what the fuck is going to happen? Am I just like literally going to turn it off mid episode? Like, I don't know.
We watched the whole thing.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
And recently.
I guess I should have mentioned that.
You had one job.
I know.
And I mean, no spoilers, but
I'm not even sure. I can't think of anything that anybody would have an issue with. So,
we're done, the three of us will have an email on this topic.
Like,
because I want to be sure.
Maybe I'm a monster. I don't know.
I mean, that's a given, but. Our second episode, Trish was very unhappy with it. And then we sat down and sort of talked about it afterwards, and she liked it better. And then the third episode is a very sort of different one. And it felt to me, from a film craft perspective, sloppier. But somehow I think I enjoyed it even more than the others. I don't know, but I'm very curious to see where it's going to go. Max has a thing on some of theirs where they have a little sort of after the episode thing, where they like talk about it and deconstruct it and stuff like that. Doom Patrol had that, and I didn't used to watch it, and then I started watching it, and I was glad I did. In a show like Station 11 that is really sort of esoteric in a lot of ways, it's very helpful to essentially debrief afterwards.
I take it back. I can't think of one thing.
All right. Well, we'll see. Once we finish it.
I can't think of one.
We should totally talk about it, but not on the air, because we don't want to spoil it for other people. But anyway.
So she says I was, Jess. Huh? Oh, yeah.
What's the
she
subject?
Symbolic reasoning versus analogy. Oh, yeah. I already said that.
I remember.
She says, I was listening to an interview with Jeffrey Hinton, sometimes called the Godfather of AI. I think I know who that is. And was interested in the distinction he was making between symbolic reasoning and reasoning by analogy. I'm not sure I completely get the distinction, but I think it's something like this. If you are teaching a child to understand the word cat, you might show the child pictures of cats. But then when the child is shown an actual cat, you would expect the child would also understand this to be a cat. Like, so in other words, the kids saw the picture of the cat, and now when they see the live cat, they understand that's the same as what was represented by the pictures. And in fact, you can show people quite abstract representations, but they will still recognize what it is because we think by analogy. So in other words, here
it's like a cat. So therefore,
yeah, so you could show a kid not a very good picture of a cat, but like not a photograph, like someone drew a picture of a cat, and the kid will know, oh, that's what this is. That represented this. Because we think by analogy. A computer which has been given a huge amount of data on what a cat might be and not given rules for organizing the data, which is what he's calling symbolic reasoning, I guess. Rules for organizing the data, symbolic reasoning, might not be able to tell when something is supposed to be a cat when a human can. So a human can see an abstract representation of a cat and go, oh, that's a cat, but the machine might not be able to do that. Because it doesn't think by analogy, it thinks by symbolic reasoning. Already, if you ask me, calling that what the computer's doing symbolic reasoning is a very confusing misnomer. That's a terrible way to describe that.
I agree. The new I feel generation, like we're shitting on Jazz, but you know.
No, she didn't make that up. That's what this Jeffrey. I think she actually kind of also would agree with us that that's not a very good way of describing that.
Sorry. Is there more to the email?
Yes. The new generation of AI is now using vectors of similarity, which are much closer to human analogic thinking. So I was thinking about the way in which humans' ability to create analogy is closely linked to sensory motor experience and wondering whether that's going to be necessary for AI to actually develop analogic reasoning, and also how social interaction would factor in to the development of analogic reasoning in AI. What do you think? So I think what the AI person means by first of all, this is very typical for AI people to think of symbolic, like the word symbol, in a very specific way. What they mean is they mean an actual, like a symbol that you would make like digitally. You know, they're not thinking about symbol the way human beings think about symbol, because the fact is analogic thinking is also symbolic. That it's ridiculous to use the word symbol. They're thinking of symbol in a very specific machine way. So what they mean is the machine has to start with some programmed element that they're going to call a symbol, and it has to figure all of that out. And humans don't have to do it like that. We don't have to do it in a way. We don't have to do it digitally. We can do it somehow analog. But what that really means, the AI scientists can't figure out. All they can say is, well, we do it, literally by analogy, analog. But I don't like the words that the AI researchers use, because I think it's confusing.
What jumped out at me, or what jumped into my brain while you were reading that, is the distinction between symbolic, well, now that I'm saying it, and representational. Because if I am seeing a thing and I'm supposed to know it's a cat, I see two ways I can determine if it's a cat. One is, I've seen things before that I've been told are cats, and this looks similar in some way. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, that's a cat, or it's something close to a cat.
Right.
It is related to a cat. The other version is you showing me a thing and it's just an X, but I have been told X is a cat. So I see a thing that says X, I'm like, that's a cat. And I don't necessarily mean it's literally a cat, but like that's a picture of a cat, because I have been told that pictures of X's are pictures of cats. And to me, the second one is symbolic, and the first one is representational. Is that all bullshit?
It depends on how you're defining your terms.
Which is William speak for yes. Because William would never say yes to me saying, is that bullshit? But he will say that.
I will say that.
Which is basically that maybe in your crazy mind, it's not bullshit.
No. That's not what it means at all. Like, I'm very frank to say, I don't like the way AI researchers typically define these things because I think it's particularly confusing.
Am I defining it in a similar way?
No, the way you're defining it makes sense. It's not the way I define it. Okay. It's not, I don't think it's the way symbolic interaction defines it. But I don't think that's particularly, I think it's clear. It's clearer than what I think the AI people are doing.
All right. So give me your version.
Well, from a symbolic interaction standpoint. Okay. So
I was not clear on the second version of how I know it's a cat. Give me analogy, analogic and symbolic ways that I, Tony, know that this thing you've got is a cat.
Well, first let's talk about why you can see an abstract representation of a cat and know when you see a real cat that that's a cat. And the reason you can do that is to say, oh, we think in terms of analogy, that really begs the question. I mean, what does that even mean? And what it means is...
Well, that's where I get representational, because in my mind, that answer is, despite being abstracted, has similar aspects to what I know to be a cat. Therefore, I assume it is a cat or related to a cat.
But from a symbolic interactionist standpoint, that still begs the question. The answer is, we human beings... The reason we understand the connection between the abstract and the concrete is because it's just how our brains work. We always only have the abstract in a way. Even when we see a real cat, what we're seeing is our brain's representation of that cat. It might be in the real world, we might be able to touch it and everything like that. But the fact of the matter is, our brains, are pretty much always dealing with some kind of abstraction. This is why we have hallucinations. This is why we have, tricks of perception.
Optical illusions.
Optical illusions.
And auditory illusions. Sensory illusions.
Sure. Somehow, something about the way we process knows, and we don't like consciously know, but we're used to, we somehow get used to through childhood somehow to the notion that anything in the world that we can touch and manipulate or whatever, as you said, can be represented many different ways, including in abstract ways. I mean, it's just a part of how we perceive things. It's built in. It's built into how we think. So it's not that just that we think in representative ways or analog ways, like, because sometimes when people say that, they don't really have a mechanism for how or why that happens. And it's only symbolic interaction, as far as I know, says, well, it's because it's just built in to how the brain actually works. We don't learn it that way. We're not taught that way. We don't really absorb it that way. Somehow the brain knows, like when we see an optical illusion, most of us don't freak out, right? Like, we get it, you know, we understand it's an optical illusion. Why don't we freak out? Why don't we think that's like hocus pocus or magic or whatever? And maybe some people would do that, but for the most part, human beings are perfectly comfortable with the idea that sometimes they don't perceive things exactly as they are. I know a lot of people think that we're not that self-reflective, and I'm not saying we are. I'm saying that there are things that are sort of built into how we experience the world where we're prepared for a cat to be more than just a cat.
Okay, you have sufficiently explained this, I'm going to say, postulate.
I don't know.
No, I'm being very serious here. I understand your point. Now apply it to the question at hand. Because while what you just said sounds interesting, I don't see how we then can use that to address this question.
Okay, so connected to that is human beings, when they process information, they don't just use what's going on in their head. They use things in their environment. They use what they think is going on in someone else's head. For example, when you're in a movie theater and you're watching a comedy and everybody else laughs, you might laugh too, but you're not just copying them or just going along with them. You're using their mental processing to supplement your own. And you, at that moment, actually find it funny. Now, later on, you might watch the movie and think, why did I think this was funny when I was in the theater? But it's not because you were...
If you're in the wild, in a place where a certain type of animal exists, and an animal that doesn't tend to exist in that part comes by, depending on how obvious and extreme the difference is, you might misconstrue that as being an animal that would make sense to live there. Because in your head, you're like, it clearly can't be a leopard. Leopards don't live in Washington. It must be a bobcat.
So, yes, you're using your environment to help you process the information.
Or you're showing me a picture, and I'm like, that's clearly not a pornographic picture, because William wouldn't show me a pornographic picture. It must be something else. Yes.
That's a good idea. Well, here's another one.
So I got that too. I got that
when groups used to hunt, you know, they often didn't talk to one another while they were approaching their prey. They could see what the other person was doing, and all that unconscious processing made them move as like one thing. So your brain is processing things through the environment, but also through what you perceive is going on in the brains of other people.
Yeah.
Computers don't do any of that.
Okay.
It's all just in here. So you've got to make the computer. So she's talking about social interaction. It can't just be like this kind of social interaction, like reciprocal talking or whatever. You can't just work with respect to something. You have to be able to work with it. And to work with it, you have to let the processing that's going on in the environment, and like even in the, so like as you and I are talking, I'm not just taking in my environment or what you look like. I am trying to guess even what you're thinking. I'm trying to get into your head. And I'm using that to inform what I say and do. I don't know how you get a computer to do that, but until it can, it's not going to process things in a way where it, right now computers can, it's only what you put something in and something comes out. Now, things can emerge, like it can think of things that you didn't program, but only because of the algorithm that you did
as,
put in
as
there.
As a combination of what's in.
Right.
I have always, and maybe I'm not wrong, I have been dabbling in AI image generation. A little, playing around with it. And I guess I've sort of always assumed the current state of AI, I largely assume, operates on more robust versions of how a search engine operates.
I think that's mostly that, correct. Yes.
So like for image generation, for example, I am typing in things and the engine in question has just tons of data on images and the words attached to those images. And so it's like, he said that word. And most of the time when people use that word, it corresponds to this aspect of an image. And so I said, this word. These are the most common things associated with those. And I know how to put them together. Here's an image.
Yeah,
that's how
right.
I've assumed it is. And so in that process, it is just actuarial. It's just a spreadsheet. It's just math.
Well, and it might be that humans even work a little bit that way to make a first draft, right? To like put something on the paper.
Yeah.
But after they have...
I mean, yeah.
The thing on the paper, they can do more creative things with it.
And then we also get into the whole the neural pathways in the brain, and the more you use a neural pathway, the more likely you are to use that neural pathway again, et cetera, et cetera.
All
et cetera,
that,
et cetera.
Right.
What you are saying is there is another point. What I don't enjoy about this conversation, besides the company, is we're stuck at a dead end, because what you're saying is humans have an increased capacity that they just have. Mm-hmm. And that's a non-starter in discussion. So can you give us any insights? Does anybody know why? Has anybody got any theories as to how or why at this point? Or credible theories?
Okay. So there.
And keep it short, because we're nearing the end of time and I really got to pee. So
you do have a lot of people who look at AI as so everything I'm talking about is an interactional and social thing. There are a lot of people who think of even human intelligence as being super individualistic, right? Like we develop these things as individuals. Of course we don't.
The whole, how do I know that my version of Red is the same version of Red?
So they're so focused on AI emerging as an individual entity that they'll probably never figure it out, because that's not how intelligence seems to emerge as far as we know so far. Now, there are AI people who are saying, you know what? What we have to have is we have to start with something that is an infant. We have to start with something that's like a human infant and let it grow up, and let it grow up in the same way that humans do. Like, not either we have to do that to figure out how it really works so that we can make AIs that don't have to do that, or to discover that all AIs have to start that way. And so to answer your question, what people think is that there's something about having a certain substrate that has the capacity through interaction. And what symbolic interactionists say is you internalize the sort of feedback loop that is interaction, that loop is the thing that creates the complex processing environment for you to use not just your brain, but also your whole body, your environment, and what you presume is the thoughts and feelings of the person you're interacting with, to help you act with people, not just with respect to people. So it's not impossible in theory for an AI to have human level intelligence, but it's starting to be suspected that for that to happen, it has to develop in the same way that human intelligence has emerged evolutionarily through all of the different forms, and still how it emerges from infants to adults. It's kind of the same process, just with infants. You know, what the infant shows us is pretty much how evolutionarily it took place over millions of years through different forms too.
But okay, so if I'm in a situation where I've got an AI that operates the way I described.
Yes.
And at the end, it generates an image for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's say the coders or whatever have put in a component where I then say, yeah, that was a good job. Or no, that was bullshit.
You kind of can do that.
Is that not, admittedly, on a dumbed down level, a simulation of that feedback loop?
Sure. Simulation.
And crucially, there is a human component to that.
Correct.
Which is like, it's way harder if you do one AI doing that with another AI, because all they would have to go on is their own data, which.
But also,
may not
as
be
you,
the same, but is the same.
But
is,
also,
is taught the same way.
Yes. And also, as you keep interacting with the AI saying, hey, good job, or no, do this, you're going to run into situations where, okay, that's not what a person would say or do right now. Like when I interact with image things, I get very frustrated because I can give it very basic instructions that it does not understand, that a human would very easily understand.
But this is a critical thing. Artificial intelligence is the term.
Mm-hmm.
The term is not artificial human intelligence.
Well, there's usually considered strong AI and weak AI, and strong AI is usually supposed to be equivalent or near equivalent to human intelligence, and weak AI is just smart machines. I mean,
I guess because my thought is like, we can conceive of an alien intelligence. So why can it not be that? But I guess since we don't have an example of an alien intelligence.
Well, but we have us. I mean,
that's the reason, what I mean. Our only definition of intelligence is human, because we don't have another example, even though we can conceive of the idea of another example. We don't have one.
No, and we...
The only comparison we can do is to human intelligence.
But humans did emerge spontaneously from a substrate. Yeah, yeah. So there's no reason to think that a different substrate, it couldn't emerge from that. But how does it do that? That's the that's the question that nobody knows the answer to, except by looking at humans. But how do we replicate that in a computer substrate versus a biological substrate? We don't even know how to get
really meta, because the concept of intelligence is by definition a human invention.
Right. And like, we can't even take near human intelligent species and like, you know, lift them beyond that or whatever. We can't even do that. So, I mean, we know broadly speaking how it happens in human beings. It just happens through human interaction. But so some people are thinking, well, what we need to do is we need to get a machine that has, at least analogously, has the same number of neural connections that a human has, so we can at least replicate the structural whatever.
Yeah.
And then have some basic learning substrates that we're pretty sure are mostly what a baby or at least a chimpanzee would have, and then have some kind of interactional protocol and interact with them like we would a child with this learning algorithm and enough neural connections, and see if it just magically happens. You know, who knows?
And we make a Five Nights at Freddy's. So most of you are asleep now. If you're an artificial intelligence and want to comment on this, go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghead.com. Talk to us about it. If you're a natural intelligence, you can also go. Also, if you're really dumb, still, go ahead. Go to the blog. Tell us your thoughts. I found this really interesting. Again, present company excluded. Why couldn't I be like, Jazz, what's your schedule like?
Yeah,
we could just switch out anyway. But this should be a great example. You should write in themagicaltalkinghead@gmail.com, and we'll talk about this kind of shit, maybe, or whatever kind of shit you want to talk about. Like, we've gotten bad jokes, lots of them. We've never gotten any dumb ideas. I want somebody to email in and be like, I keep having this thought, and it's really dumb, but I have this thought. What do you think about? Like, I want that. Because I get those sometimes. I'm like, that's really dumb, but it's interesting. So anyway, check it out. Also, if you haven't, watch RRR. Phenomenal movie. Really great stuff, and unlike anything you've seen. Also, if you want to catch up on Station 11, maybe by the time we finish, then you can get in on the private conversation me and William and Jazz will have about why Jazz hates humanity and why William's a monster. And it'll be 2 weeks for us, but you'll be back in a week, and you get to hear all about my Virginia trip. And William will tell you about why he is dumber than an iPad. Like a new iPad, not like the original.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.